we're still early because the hard work is all of that retooling. The average person doesn't follow that, doesn't see it. But those are the necessary steps that need to pave the way for all of this to come after it. But then once it happens, it seems so obvious.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Join us as we delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver market insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit subscribe for your bi-weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto's a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid anytime, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining this week's episode of the Crypto Brief. First one of the new year, very exciting. Joining me today is Jack Neureiter, Matt Allen, and a special guest, very near and dear to our hearts on the pod, Chris Kuiper. You know him as the resident suit coiner of 2025, also VP of research at FDA. Super excited to have you all here. We're going to talk the 2026 look ahead today. It's an annual report the research team does every single year. And it's the most fun for us. We really get to talk about whatever's on our mind going into 2026. That's why we've got Chris on to discuss that today. Before we get into that, Matt, I know we had one important story. Why don't you take it away really quick?
Yeah, certainly. So we have an exciting 7 days coming up as we look towards a crypto market structure bill. So next week, both the Senate Agriculture and Senate Banking Committees are looking to advance drafts of this crypto market structure bill. So if both versions were to pass, a synthesized version of that bill would have to pass a full Senate vote. And then the Senate and the House would have to put together a fully synthesized version of the bill that would have to then pass the House as well. So just for context, the Clarity Act has already passed in the House, but there are marked differences between the Senate version of the bill and the Clarity Act. So we're just looking to advance a synthesized version through both houses of Congress. So definitely potential movement on the market structure front, which is very exciting, something we've been following for a long time now. So it'll be an exciting next week and definitely more to come here.
We will be looking at you, Matt, to keep us updated. Thank you so much. Getting right into it, the 2026 look ahead is already out at fidelitydigitalassets.com for our listeners, and it's in the show notes. So look there. Chris, gentlemen, it feels silly to ask you to introduce yourself, but for our listeners, why don't you give us some of your story and what the look ahead means to you?
Yeah, so Chris Kuiper, VP of research, as you said, at Fidelity Digital Asset. And Max, of course, is a part of that. Jack used to be, so great to be back with Jack. And the look ahead has a great history of at least 5 or more years. We've been doing it as long as I'm here. I'm on my 5th calendar year, so we'll be hitting that milestone. Jack, you were maybe one of the very first ones. But as you said, Max, we love to have fun with this one. This is where we get to look back over the last year, see what themes emerged, and then put that into context of the new year. We get to go a little bit out on a limb with maybe not predictions, but things that we think we could see or things that are going to be the most important for people to follow. So everyone gets a section. So you get to see a wide range of opinions and voices in this one. So it's a great report. Check it out.
Yeah, Jack, I'm sure you're getting flashbacks to the good old days. Do you remember writing yours?
Yeah, I'm jealous that I don't get to express my ideas and put them out there on paper that sees the public's eyes. I enjoyed reading the report this year for sure.
Maybe we get some of your thoughts as a special guest today to add on. Maybe we tack you on at the end to see what you guys think is going on in 2026 to get into our report. We kind of covered so many topics, but Chris, talk to me about shipping containers.
Yeah, I've gotten into the habit of writing a little intro, and it's always really hard to try to encapsulate the year with either some kind of metaphor or thing that we make a connection to. Many years we make a connection to a reading we've done as the group. One of them in the past years was by this economist, Perez, talking about how, you need the financialization side to drive innovation. So that was a big theme before. This year, I drew on, if anyone's read the book, it's been out for many years now, a big nonfiction book called The Box by Mark Levinson. Fascinating book, and it goes through the history of the shipping container. So the big steel rectangular containers that you see in these cargo ships that get loaded onto trucks and trains and everything else seems so obvious today that you would standardize this, you would have an entire industry built around this. But if you go through the story of it, it went through decades of trying, of this person single-handedly almost trying to get this adopted, meeting resistance within the transportation industry, outside of it, all along the way. And of course, the public didn't see any of this. This is an area, unless that you're in logistics or work in the industry, you don't see it. But it impacted literally everyone's life around the globe now. The fact that you can get stuff shipped to you around the world for mere pennies is amazing. The shipping costs of goods used to be the determining factor of whether a good could be profitable. With the box, that dropped to the point where the shipping cost is negligible. It's not really in the calculation. A few other examples from the book was you had to see the retooling of existing industries. So for example, where you saw people take weeks, literal hand loading and unloading ships took weeks, got brought down to mere hours with cranes and crane operators. But you had to retool. You had to retool the entire port. You had to install the cranes. Sometimes you had to move the entire port. You had to train crane operators. And so the point is, I think that's what we're seeing in the digital asset industry. 2025 was a year where we're on the surface. Price was down, flat, or even worse for a lot of other assets. And people didn't see a whole lot if they didn't work in the industry. They said, my banking hasn't changed. My investments haven't changed. I still pay with my credit card. But underneath the surface, you saw all kinds of retooling. You saw every single major bank make an announcement this year that they're either doing something or they're going to do something. Just this week, we saw a mega bulge bracket bank announce filing of ETFs for them, for crypto products. And just today, they said they're going to launch a wallet as well. So my point is, this is all getting integrated. It's all getting retooled in the background. The change is happening. And sooner or later, people are going to see it. And it's going to, in my opinion, affect everyone's life.
I love it. It's such a relevant, I guess, analogy for this podcast as well, in particular. Like, these are the stories we're covering constantly, week after week. It's almost like beating the same drum for the past year. And, you know, it just kind of never ends. Chris, I'm curious, like, at what point do we know the shipping containers, like, what phase are we in there, right? When did the shipping container change the whole world? You said it took roughly 10 years.
More than, I think, decades. But I think we're still early because the hard work is all of that retooling. Like, think about moving an entire port. Think about retooling your entire workforce from most of them loading and unloading ships to coming down to one person doing that. And what we're seeing is all these big banks have to figure out, how am I going to custody this? What does this mean for compliance? How do I get in line with regulators? We saw tons of movement on the regulatory front in 2025. Again, the average person doesn't follow that, doesn't see it, but those are the necessary steps that need to pave the way for all of this to come after it. So, boy, it'd be hard to put a specific date on it, but it takes longer than people think. But then once it happens, it seems so obvious. But I think we're still pretty early.
And the tough part is it's very difficult to stay on top of it and see everything that's going on in the background. And that's why I think it's such a good analogy. Curious, Matt and Jack, you know, is there anything that stuck out to you guys, especially being so close to everything that's been going on the past year?
Yeah, well, I think the whole report itself covers topics that we've all been following and talking about in this podcast, right? It's all of the things that are near and dear to all of our hearts. But I think building off of something that Chris just said and maybe extending his analogy a little bit, another complication with retooling all of the shipping globally is that you have nation states. And so not only does one nation state need to retool all of their own individual shipping, but everyone needs to coordinate globally, which is a very large challenge. And obviously, as we've discussed on the brief, we've seen movement on the regulatory space in the US, But we're going to need to see some form of global coordination and consensus around how all of this is going to work in the future. And I think that's going to be a large hurdle and that we're moving at a steady and exciting pace. But it's something that I think will be very interesting to follow and we'll definitely continue to cover on the brief through the course of 2026.
Yeah, I will say when I first opened the report, I skimmed through to see like who wrote what in each section, just because I was curious like what the sections were. And then I saw the conclusion and it was like, you know, brief conclusion. So I read it and I was like, shipping containers, what? What is shipping? It's like, what is this? And then I was like, oh, this is definitely one of Chris's analogies, but they're always very well thought out. And then I went back through and like when I was reading it, like in the introduction and stuff, it is mentioned like a lot of what you just went through, Chris. It really is a great analogy that resonates where it's like everybody within crypto, you know, a lot of people that get really excited about it are talking about like how it's going to change the world. And like, it's almost like it's talked about like it's going to happen overnight. And in reality, all of these, you know, pieces of financial infrastructure and plumbing that have existed for decades and decades, like they exist for a reason and maybe they're suboptimal, but like inertia means the status quo will stay for longer than you think it will. And these systems have to be like materially better for incumbents to adopt them and use them, or for users of the, you know, incumbent companies to switch over to, you know, the upstarts that are embracing this technology. And like, it does feel like it's all sort of starting to happen, but to your point, like, takes a long time to rework a lot of these systems when they're in place, because it's not just a simple switchover of one single thing. Max, maybe to segue into a topic I think we wanted to talk about was your section on token holder rights and equity versus token on the venture side. I know we have considerations around a lot of this when we make investments in an equity business that maybe will have a token, or a token that has an equity component when it's being created. And then that leads to these weird like implications. So curious your thoughts on the section that you wrote.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably one of the areas that is like, could almost call it like a last mover. Like everybody's been prioritizing the infrastructure, building everything out, make sure we can scale to, you know, millions and billions. Yet, you know, it's almost like an afterthought in terms of token design, right? It's what it seems like looking back historically. And the big theme I noticed in 2025, kind of later in 2025, was kind of the buyback meta, right? And I didn't just stop there in my section. I kind of got a bit hand wavy in terms of predicting like what would be next, right? I'm assuming it's not going to stop in terms of like the increasing prioritization of token holders, right? Like that's the trend we've identified in 2025. I expect that to continue in 2026, but also not just be constrained to like value flow in the system, right? That's like a very specific angle or a very specific part of the overall token design. So I decided to focus a bit more on like just the broad stroke of token holder rights, right? And a few examples I give, which like kind of hand wavy, as I mentioned, are fair primary distributions. That's one we're like starting to see pick up a bit. And then some more predictions a bit like further out on a limb were like more robust governance frameworks. I've had strong feelings about the one token, one vote model for a long time, and I think it could definitely be improved, among many other things. But that was just one example that I think, you know, it would just naturally benefit token holders. To your point, I think we already have some solutions that are just 10 times better and worth changing to. It's just a matter of like prioritizing that now. And that's what we're starting to see, like some of the big names in the space do already. I wrote about the Uniswap unification, you know, proposal getting passed recently. So, and keep in mind, I did write the section before Uniswap proposed that. Okay, I have it on the record. They just beat me to the delivery. So, but anyway, that's yeah. What are your thoughts there? I'm curious.
I would imagine, because I know how these reports are done, like you're thinking about the topics for this like months ahead of time, and all this Aave discussion between Aave and the Aave Labs, like Equity Co, having sort of like public drama and back and forth, like that has become really pertinent over the past month or so. And then the discussion around Uniswap and unification. It's interesting to see these like large legacy blue chip protocols that were created, you know, years ago in a time where people maybe weren't thinking through these implications that like equity holders would come out with, you know, they would own a share of tokens, some pro rata share of tokens relative to their equity ownership. But then, you know, they might dispose of those tokens later when they get liquidity on them, which is a rational thing to do for a venture investor. But then they still own the equity business. And for some of these, like for Uniswap and Aave specifically, just mentioning because they're large and they've been talking about some of this, is like they then have front ends that the equity labs business is creating and monetizing. And they're using the underlying protocol, and they're, you know, there's not a great answer to some of this, as you know, sort of mentioned. It's like something that's going to have to be worked through. I do think like more recent projects that have been launched, there's been more collective thought ahead of time into the fact that like, okay, is there a labs business, and does that labs business have any terminal value or not? And like, let's be more explicit about it. But to your point, like there should be like standards and systems in place that we evolve into over time. And I think there will be.
Yeah. And I just want to build off that, Max. I think your section was very interesting and very exciting. I actually remember doing research back in 2020 on like governance tokens and value accrual and not being able to draw a clear conclusion between, okay, like this protocol usage increases, but how does that value accrual mechanism move down the stack to users? And that connection there wasn't very clear, but I think you did a very good job of highlighting some of the recent announcements and the way Hyperliquid has been able to use buybacks to actually increase that value accrual. And then from an investment perspective, you start to look at those buybacks and now you have a clear investment thesis for how usage increases value to users and holders of the tokens, which seems relatively simple when you think about it from like a more standard traditional investment thesis, but it's just something that we haven't seen codified in this space yet, which I think is very exciting.
And Max, we've also discussed like there's some of these weird quirks that like just because early crypto protocols that have tokens on chain started to do it, like it became the standard. And like to me, like buybacks has started to become one where it's like, well, what do you do with excess revenue? You just buy back your token to return value. But if you think of like a lot of these protocols are like early stage, you know, cash flowing entities or software protocols. If you had like a traditional business, you wouldn't be like paying dividends or buying back shares. Often you'd be reinvesting in the business. But in crypto, it's like the de facto thing to do with the excess cash flow is not to like hire more people and try to scale this thing and grow into like other lines of business. It's to like return the capital to token holders, which is an interesting quirk. And maybe we grow or don't grow out of that at some point. And then the other thing I know we've talked about is like this concept of fully diluted valuation. And there's like all of these tokens that like the treasury holds onto, and they may or may not go into circulation, but everybody bakes them into the valuation. It's just, there's a couple of like weird quirks within like token dynamics that we've just accepted them as like, everybody does it, so we'll do it, but it feels like suboptimal. And maybe the market will mature out of these alongside the governance things that you discussed.
And it's all started with Bitcoin with their supply cap. Now everybody just has a supply cap. To me, that doesn't make too much. But yes, to your point, there's an endless list. To Matt's point, I think you mentioned an interesting thing, like it's not codified yet. Like I think, I'm not saying that what is going on right now is like the end goal or like makes sense or will be the standard, but there's clearly some trend. And sure, Jack, to your point, maybe we tip way over like the other side of the scale and prioritize token holders way too much. So yeah, it's definitely wide open, but that's what I think is exciting because there's so many opportunities, like you said. Enough about my section though. Chris, I really, to Jack's point, I loved the conclusion specifically, but if you want to highlight, because I know you mentioned it already, but if you want to highlight kind of what you were most excited to see, what you're looking forward to in 2026, and maybe any other sections that you thought, you know, were notable personally.
Sure. So I'll run through a couple of sections just to tease people and get them to read the full report. But Marta has a wonderful section on the convergence of TradFi and crypto. And I think this is a big theme we saw. It's going to be even bigger. It's funny because it's a bit of a catch-22 where the original Bitcoin people and the cypherpunks viewed this as a system to go against the traditional financial system. And now people are bemoaning the fact they're converging. But it's a catch-22 because it's like, well, if you thought this was going to be successful, what did you think what was going to happen, right? They were going to adopt Wall Street and finance as a business adopts the best products and technologies out there, same as what Fidelity does and what we've been doing. So I view personally that as a great thing. And she gives a lot of stats on just showing how big these markets are. These are not small time markets. They're very big. They're very liquid. You've got massive options markets, futures markets, all these other things. And so it's moving in parallel, just like traditional finance. Zach Wainwright on our team has been following the Bitcoin treasury companies specifically. That was a huge theme of 2025, something we think that will just continue. And then he also pivots over to what does he think hash rate's going to do? And he's got maybe a hot take that this chart of up and to the right of hash rate is actually going to stall or maybe even decline in 2026 because these companies are finding it so much more profitable to pivot to AI. Daniel on our team covers Knots versus Core for anyone who's really into the weeds on that one. That's a great read. And then he also touches on the quantum threat, which I think that's going to be a big theme of 2026. So we'll hear a lot more on that. I end the section on the macro stuff along with Matt. Matt gives a great bull bear points. So readers can take both those sides and decide for themselves how things are looking on the macro front. I'm honest at the end. I offer a little bit of a mea culpa in that last year's report, I said, why is nobody talking about the potential for stagflation? Thankfully, we didn't get it. It wasn't my base case, but I did think we still saw very high probabilities of inflation coming back. Thankfully, we didn't. It did go lower. Although I will point out, we are still not near that 2% target, or I guess we're getting close, but notice how the goalposts have changed. So I still think that's something to look at. But what's interesting is that maybe we didn't get stagflation, but if you looked at gold in 2025, you would have thought it was a stagflation environment, up 65% this year, the fourth best calendar year for gold in its history since we went off the gold standard. And so I build on that. And one of my favorite charts is to show that same drivers, same things underpinning it on the macro front. I think a lot more investors are going to come around to the fact that Bitcoin is potentially a better way because it has much better characteristics than gold. And then I show how gold and Bitcoin actually go back and forth, looking at the 90-day rolling under or outperformance of the two. And counterintuitively, I think that's a great thing because if it was just gold or gold on steroids, people would say, well, why don't I just own gold or lever up gold and have a high leverage gold play? This way, if the correlation stays low, you can actually improve your risk-adjusted returns on a portfolio basis by adding Bitcoin and gold potentially. So that could be a big thing that a lot of institutional investors hopefully come to realize and start to notice in 2026.
That's such a good chart. And like the exact comment you answer, like I've heard this question, why not just own gold? And like this chart is the reason, well, you can at least see the relationship very clearly. So I love that inclusion. And I'm sure we're all appreciative of, you know, you taking one on the arm, right? I really appreciate that. And I think you did a great job this time. Matt, I was curious, since we had mentioned kind of Zach's maybe hot take around AI's impact on hash rate and mining, you know, business as a whole. I know you're very, you know, well-versed in the space. What are your thoughts? Would you agree with the hot take? Do you think it's a hot take?
So I would say I don't think that it's a hot take. My base case, I think, for the past 12 months has been that large Bitcoin miners will continue to accelerate their push into AI. And I think there's a fundamental reason for that. And it's raising capital, right? If you are going to go host GPUs for a hyperscaler, and Zach mentions this in the report, and we've seen it this year, and we've mentioned it on the podcast, we saw massive deals with public Bitcoin miners making deals with AWS, with Microsoft. And these are really exciting deals, and you contract those revenues, right? You know, if you're a Bitcoin miner, you're subject to the network conditions and the difficulty adjustments. Whereas if you're hosting GPUs, you have a hosting contract for X number of years, you can then go to a bank and raise financing against that. So I think from a capital allocation play, it makes perfect sense these large Bitcoin miners would be pivoting towards AI. And actually, my base case is that as an industry, we will see an emergence of smaller more niche plays on Bitcoin mining, where the play is really just accessing cheap, unwanted energy that is a smaller scale, that's not really attractive to the hyperscalers, but it's so cheap that it's attractive to Bitcoin miners. So I think we're starting to see a rotation away from these large utility scale Bitcoin mining operations into these smaller scale, more niche power plays. Now, there is one caveat that I will add to this theory, which is something that I've been following and something I will continue to follow in 2026, is the continued push into Bitcoin mining financial products. So currently, the way most miners fund their expansions is through equity issuance. Now, in a kind of a traditional finance sense, that's typically your most expensive source of capital. And the reason for that has really just been there's no other option for Bitcoin miners. But we're starting to see some small upstarts come out with interesting hash rate hedging products, abilities to actually finance your mining operation in a way that does not involve equity issuance. I think if we see a proliferation or a strong acceleration in that direction, we could see some miners that have pivoted more towards AI coming back to the Bitcoin mining market, just because then the cost-benefit analysis is not that, oh, I can only raise capital against my contracted AI revenues, but now I can actually raise capital against my contracted AI revenues and my hedged Bitcoin mining revenues, and I can have a more balanced portfolio of how I'm using my power. So it's an interesting space that is still in its very early days, but something I'm really excited to see over the course of 2026.
Yeah, I can't say that that construction or that structure is something I've really heard of. Have you seen like existing companies already start to explore those options or that structure?
Yeah, certainly. There have been some companies that have been pushing this market forward actually for years. They're a much smaller scale and some of the public order books are relatively thin. So we see some large miners taking them up on these hedging products. But the problem being is that, again, the market order books are relatively thin. And if you're really large scale and you want to hedge a significant portion of your hash rate, the market just isn't deep enough for that yet. So as we continue to see upstarts push into this space, I'm hoping that we see innovations that allow that market to deepen and mature.
It's kind of like an odd chicken and the egg situation. Like it seems like it would be attractive, or the miners in this particular, like, have that demand, they have that need, but like there's no one to fill the other side. I'm curious if anyone has thoughts, like what it would take to get the order books deeper, give them the products that they need.
I mean, I can say just from experience that one aspect is just competition. The spreads are really wide right now. So if you want to hedge, it can be relatively expensive, or in realistic terms, what you're giving up is a lot of upside. So you have players that will take the other side just at steep discounts.
I see. Okay. More market participants that are fitting into the shipping container structure, right, Chris? I'm curious from both of you or Chris, if there's anything else you think maybe you wished you included, or just like any other thoughts that, maybe we can provide that don't spoil the report too much, but other thoughts that you might be looking at that might be new, something may have wanted to include. Because, I always have some thoughts. Oh, maybe I should have written about XYZ. That's going to be big, right? I know privacy has been a huge push just like very recently. It was almost like before we started really thinking about this. And that's been a big trend and I assume will be.
Yeah, since Jack said he wished he was writing it, we'll let him say what he would have written. And also from your unique vantage point too, Jack, I'd like to hear.
Yeah. It sort of intersects with what I'm finding exciting these days on the venture side, which is maybe taking the sort of crypto institutional markets convergence story like a step deeper or a step like more on-chain native, which is like two things, like tokenization and DeFi and sort of the intersection of the two, which I think, again, it's all interrelated. But I think DeFi historically has created these pretty robust platforms that enable permissionlessness, accessibility to core financial primitives. I think of mainly trading assets, borrowing and lending, derivatives, and then now we're seeing these asset management like vaults with various like risk curators overlaying the top, and then being able to help manage those assets in a programmatic way. And historically, I think all of this DeFi infrastructure, the assets or the TVL that sits inside of these protocols was one of two things. It was either circular and speculative in nature tokens that were just largely unsustainable because they were like governance tokens on unsustainable protocols, or we went through meme coins and NFTs, etc. Now, granted, I don't think many of those made their way into like collateral on lending protocols, but we did see some of those. Probably some that still exist. And then the other piece, which has been more sustainable and makes up the vast majority of TVL today, is like large base layer assets like Ethereum, Solana, or stake various wrapped or staked versions of those tokens, wrapped Bitcoin, and then stable coins largely to be lent against those assets as collateral. And if we look at like sort of last year, according to RWA.xyz, I just looked at the numbers really quickly. You started the year, if you strip away stablecoins and US Treasury related assets like tokenized money market funds, you started the year with $1.9 billion in tokenized assets. And you ended the year, right around now, at just under $10.5 billion. So in the grand scheme of like global assets and even in the grand scheme of crypto, it's still really, really small, but grew roughly 5x. And so I think like tokenized private credit, tokenized public equities and fixed income, commodities, infrastructure assets and funds, tokenized hedge funds even are starting to like be created in a super early stage. And we saw like pretty meaningful growth last year. I think we're going to see that continue to accelerate. And then we see platforms like Aave Horizon, which is just the institutional RWA version of Aave on Ethereum. They doubled in deposits and borrows since mid-October. So that's the past quarter. It's, again, still really small, $600 million in deposits and $200 million in borrows, but that's double what it was a quarter ago. And so I think you're going to see like borrowing and lending platforms bring utility to assets that are tokenized, and we're just seeing more assets continue to be tokenized. And I think that that's like going to be a major trend. And then on the venture side, right, I'm sort of looking at what are the interesting protocols and projects and equity businesses that are needed to support and bring utility to these assets that are coming on chain.
To me, that makes so much sense. I think there's been a clear like phase shift already in the past about like what people are using DeFi for, right? Like in the beginning, it really just seemed like, leverage on the native asset, right? So if you're, have a lending platform on Solana, it's like the users are there to borrow and lend SOL and go, however many X long SOL or have their strategy that they're doing. Now it's almost seemed like you mentioned a lot of the activity focused on stable coins, right? And then now you're saying the next shift is, all these other assets. So it makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, no, all of that growth in stablecoins, like it begets like idle capital on chain that then like some portion of those users are keeping those deposits on chain for whatever reason. And like some portion of those users that keep their assets on chain, like that are just sitting there are like, okay, well, what can I do with it? So even if it's like 10% of that number, if you're bullish on stablecoins, then there's all this idle capital. It leads to like low borrowing costs on chain. Eventually somebody takes advantage of that. And that sort of like creates this, I think, like reflexive cycle of like, low cost to borrow brings collateral on chain borrows, that makes the rates attractive, right? That's sort of like crypto has been super cyclical in the borrow rates on these borrow lend platforms because all the assets have been crypto native. But what happens when you have yield sources and assets that are uncorrelated? Well, I think then it starts to become a little bit like less cyclical to crypto cycles, a little bit more stable. But that's my view.
I like it. Less reflexive. Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. Yeah, I love it too. Chris, Matt, anything else you'd want to tack on the end of our look ahead? We'll just stick a post-it note on the bottom for you guys.
No, I'll just tack on, go to fidelitydigitalassets.com and read it.
Yes. Please do.
Yeah, I would just echo that. It's a great report. I really enjoyed it.
Awesome. Thank you all, gentlemen, and our listeners. Chris, especially you, thanks so much for, just being such a huge voice for our team, our industry. People on the podcast support you. So thank you so much for joining. And Happy New Year, everyone. Looking forward to another great year of the Crypto Brief.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results.
Custody and trading of digital assets are provided by Fidelity Digital Assets National Association, which is a national trust bank.
This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2025 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.